It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplexes and at the art house.
Warehouse, farmhouse, hen house, outhouse, or doghouse in that area.
You'll also hear about new and old films on Blu-ray and on DVD. Plus, you'll hear all the latest Hollywood gossip.
I don't care!
Okay, maybe not the latter, but it is time for Film Sociology with WFYI's film guru.
Kaiser Shizzy!
No, that's Matthew Sosi.
It's such a fine line between stupid and clever, yes.
Let's see how thin the line is. Here's your host, Matthew Sosi.
Film lovers and air guitarists, welcome to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD to the Point and WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y at WFYI.org. Also, the show is available as a podcast. It's also available on iTunes. I am on Facebook and on Twitter at Matthew Sosi. We have a podcast, and it's on iTunes, and we have a blog, which you can check out at
filmsociology.tumblr.com.
The man who does not only air drums, but air Fender Rhodes, sometimes at the same time, that is Kobe Slagle.
Hello, hello.
Yes, if you're tuning in and you know the intro song, you should know that Matt and I air drum and air guitar.
It does bring
during
us into
the intro
warm up.
Yes, I'm the drummer. Course. Matt plays the guitar.
It's music from the Warriors. And by the way, I know there are air guitar competitions across this great globe of ours.
Yes, there are.
There's a fun documentary called Air Guitar Nation.
Mm-hmm.
It's real easy to do air guitar for rock. I think there should be movie music, jazz.
Oh yeah.
A blues division. I think it'd be good if you could air guitar like Wes Montgomery or Grant Green.
Sit down classical nylon string.
I think that's
with
a good
a
idea.
Footstool.
Absolutely. Elmore James in the blues slide division. Robert Johnson and Sun House in the acoustic division.
The Robert Randolph pedal steel section.
Thank you. Calvin Cook. The Campbell Brothers, of course. That's yeah. So I think. Why are you just limiting it to rock?
The Larry Carlton hollow body smooth jazz section.
That'd be good. And then Morale Coryell and his dad Larry Coryell. So yeah, I think that the possibilities are endless.
These are competitions for money too.
Oh yeah, big money, big money. And of course, they're always for
big
some reason,
money, big money. Can't play real guitar.
Thank you, Herm Edwards.
Can't play it.
For some reason, the finals are in Finland. I think they were in Oslo. They're in Norway
like
or
that.
Finland. But yeah, anyway, fun documentary. Go check out. So there's your obscure documentary title of the day, Air Guitar Nation. But yes, they should branch out. I think they really should. You can also have an Adrian Ballou section. Anyway, we're a real show. It's terrific. Second half of the show, I will be chatting with actor, director, producer, and now in the pantheon of film sociology guests, James Keach, who, besides being Stacey's brother, he produced Walk the Line. He played Jesse James in The Long Riders, among other things. He was in, you know him from National Lampoon's Vacation, Moving Violations. But he also directed the documentary Glen Campbell, I'll Be Me. And I got him in studio this past week to talk about the documentary. And so we'll get to that in a little bit. Now, of course, that documentary, which is up for an Academy Award for Best Original Song, is about Glen Campbell on his final tour, while at the same time also dealing with Alzheimer's disease as it became public. So we talked about for what it's worth, and this was not planned. It's an Alzheimer's film heavy show
yes.
today because we're going to start things off with Still Alice. I will mention what is opening in theaters today. Latest from the Wachowski siblings, Jupiter Ascending. Where apparently the fate of the world falls at the feet of Mila Kunis,
and
Channing Tatum is in there with webbed ears, I guess.
Oh,
But I'm sorry, actress and bourbon endorser Mila Kunis.
That's right.
I do like those commercials. Also, the Canadian thriller Mommy is opening at Keystone Arts, as well as The Seventh Son, starring Jeff Bridges and Julianne Moore. So you can get a Julianne Moore double feature in our fair city if you are up for that. This was a fantasy epic that apparently has been on the shelf for a while and is finally being released in theaters, even though it stars Jeff Bridges and Julianne Moore. And I've already read interviews that Mr. Bridges is not crazy about the film itself. But you can hear him chant and go to his website, and he can chant you to sleep. Anyway, we're going to start with Still Alice, which stars Julianne Moore. She's up for Best Actress for this film, and she plays a linguistics professor who's in the early stages of a rare and sadly even form of Alzheimer's disease, which we find out is also genetic. So it's will be trickling down to her kids too. Alec Baldwin is in this film, as is Kate Boswell and Stacey Studeville's favorite, Kristen Stewart.
Oh, really?
Oh, really. We'll talk about Miss Stewart in a little bit, because that just brings... I lovingly call Stacey Grumpy Cat and Kristen Stewart's Y. So anyway, here is the trailer for Still Alice.
To the most beautiful and the most intelligent woman I've known in my entire life.
Welcome, Dr. Alice Howland.
I hope to convince you that by observing these baby steps
Alice, where the hell were you?
Went for a run.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that, because you completely blew our dinner plans.
I need to talk to you. I got something wrong with me.
What's going on?
Oh, boy. He's going to break up, or...
No. I have Alzheimer's disease, early onset.
Oh my God.
I can see the words hanging in front of me, and I can't reach them, and I don't know who I am, and I don't know what I'm going to lose next. Stethoscope, Millennium, Hedgehog. I'd like to see you go to college.
You can't use your situation to just get me to do everything that
Why
you want.
Why can't I?
Because that's not fair.
I don't have to be fair. I'm your mother.
I hate this is happening to me.
But we have to keep the important things in our life going.
Merry Christmas.
We have to try, or we're going to go crazy.
This might be the last year that I'm myself.
Please don't say that.
I am not suffering. I am struggling. Struggling to be a part of things. Stay connected to who I once was. So live in the moment, I tell myself. It's really all I can do. Live in the moment.
Okay, so on paper, and you get a little bit of that with the trailer, it does sound like a disease movie. Or something that would have been on cable or on a network movie, a TV movie. Let's face it. Of course, you have a much better cast with Julianne Moore, Alec Baldwin, Kate Bosworth, and yes, actually Kristen Stewart is pretty good in this, which I'll get to in a little bit. As we hear in the trailer, Moore's character, and of course it's a nice touch that her character is a linguistics professor, but the trickling down of when the disease starts to kick in. Something as minor as what she thinks is having a brain freeze to forgetting where she's running. And we get to see the early frustrations, especially if you have an academic position like Moore's character has. So to see that frustration build, and it's handled in a subtle way. There are so many elements that we've seen in a film like where a person is stricken with the disease. Theory of Everything is another one that came out earlier this year. Of course, about Stephen Hawking, which also is a well-made disease movie. But seeing Moore's frustrations in her life, dealing with her family. Of course, she has kids, and they all handle her in different ways. Alec Baldwin makes the most out of what is the spouse role. Although it was funny, I talked with other critics and we saw Baldwin and you kept waiting for the other shoe to drop on Baldwin's character. You know, was he gonna dump her? Is he gonna be a D-bag? Is he gonna, you know, all the things that we expect from sometimes an Alec Baldwin character, and that does not happen here. Now, with Miss Stewart.
Alec Baldwin things don't happen.
Alec Baldwin things do not happen here. Well, he's not on the phone yelling at his daughter.
Mm.
Anyway. But Miss Stewart plays the daughter who is far away from the family. She's an actress, even though her dad is financing her acting career. And mom wants her to get back into college, wants her to find herself. And she actually handles Julianne Moore's character probably the best compared to the other children. And as I was telling Stacy, hi, GC. And by the way, apparently Stewart's character doesn't wash her hair either. So Stacy's happy about that. But as I said to people, and I know people just bristle at the idea of Kristen Stewart, period. But I think she gets an acting lesson working with Moore. There's one scene in particular where Stewart's character and Moore's character go from the beach over the sand dunes, across the street, heading to a house. And it's a single shot where the two of them are talking. And like a tennis player, if you play with somebody who's better than you, you volley with somebody who is better than you, you become a better player. And I think Stewart learns a lot from working with her. Obviously, we're going to see what Kristen Stewart's going to do next as far as the next few years. But I think working with Julianne Moore hopefully will be a benefit for that. It's not an overwrought film as far as handling of the subject matter. As the film goes on and Moore's character starts to go deeper and deeper, yeah, it is a bit hard. It will be hard, of course, if you have somebody or you know somebody who has this affliction. But it's really a well-made film that has been done before, but it's really well-made, and the strength of it is Julianne Moore. It avoids a lot of the cliches that you expect from a disease film. Moore's been nominated, I think, 4 times. She's up for Best Actress. And right now she's the odds-on favorite. And this is also the case that, besides the fact that she's due, it's a well-deserved performance for her to win, and I hope she does. So it's definitely worth checking out.
Yes! 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 Yes!
Okay, we got about 10 minutes before we get to our interview with James Keach. Kobe, what is happening at your alma mater?
At IU Cinema. Actually, I don't have that up yet, but tonight at the IMA.
At the IMA, yes.
We have Bringing Up Baby.
Catherine Hepburn and Cary Grant. Not Cary Grant. Cory Hart. And an animal. So that's fun. Go check that out at the IMA.
Tonight, Friday, February 6th, IU Cinema, 7 o'clock. Blade Runner, the final cut from 2007.
Okay. You haven't seen Blade Runner.
No. But they're showing the original, 1982, tomorrow, Saturday, 3 o'clock. IU Cinema, follow that. Here we go.
Yes.
Blade Runner from 1982 at 3. This is on Saturday.
Okay.
Director's Cut from 1992 at 6:30. And then Final Cut, 2007 at 9:30.
So they're just playing the whole box set right there.
Yeah.
That's cool. Because I saw Blade Runner when it came out in 82. Got to see the director's cut when I was in college. I was taking a film course at the Ball State University. And then I bought the box set, which has the final cut. So, that's fun. There's a day right there.
So, yeah, if you're looking to see Blade Runner this weekend, just go to...
Head to Bloomington.
Go down to Bloomington. And then Sunday, 3 o'clock from 1961, the drama The Exiles.
Okay.
And then follow that up at 6:30 from 1970, the foreign language war drama White Bird with a Black Mark.
All right.
IU Cinema.
That is happening over there. I want to get to a couple of DVD and Blu-ray titles this week. A film that I read a good review of in the AV Club, and then I got another good review from my dad. Yeah, my dad saw a film before I did. He's retired in Nevada, living in Nevada. But the ridiculously fun action film John Wick with Keanu Reeves. And it is directed by two guys who were stunt coordinators in the Matrix series, among other things. But it's a throwback to a 70s action story, but it's shot like a 21st century action film. Reeves plays a killing machine who is, of course, out of the loop, out of the business.
Is he coming back for one more job?
Well, no, because somebody, his wife has just died, and the tone of the film could have veered in the wrong direction several times, and it stays on course. His last gift from his now-departed wife was a dog. This is the last sign of humanity that he is able to take care of. Reeves' character, John Wick, comes across some Russian criminals who beat him up, take his car, and kill his dog. And therefore, revenge must be paid. And that's basically the gist of the film. It also helps that you have people like Willem Dafoe and John Leguizamo and Ian McShane coming off the bench for a couple of scenes each. And it has a 70s revenge tone, but it's shot like a modern film. But you have car chases and you have fight scenes that you can actually watch and follow.
Okay.
And that's all I ask. So there's a lot of long shots of Reeves beating up bad guys, shooting bad guys. And that's all you really want from a Reeves action film, I think. So it's shot well. It's shot the way an old person like me likes to see it.
Cut it so I can see it.
Cut it so I can see it. Don't be Michael Bay. Don't give me, you kids and your editing. So somebody had fun with the editing machine. So this, no, it's definitely worth renting. Although you might have to be in the mood for it.
Okay.
No, I'm kidding. Joe, go rent it.
Yes, sir. I'm looking ahead here at the IMA. We have the Winter Nights series that goes on through the end of February, February 27th.
Uh-huh.
But beyond that, I just noticed a 3-week series called Music and Movies.
Yes.
With the score performed by local musicians and singers.
Are they doing the Warriors?
Friday, April 10th, 7 p.m., Good, Bad, Ugly.
Ooh.
Saturday, April 11th, Bonnie and Clyde.
Ooh, good
stuff. And Pump Up the Volume on April 17th.
I'll have to watch that again. Everyone's favorite renegade DJ, Christian Slater.
And then they have another series, Serial Cinema.
Killer or Breakfast Food?
Breakfast Food, because it looks like it's Saturdays.
Not.
Saturdays from 10 to noon. Breaking 2, Electric Boogaloo.
Oh, my God.
Pee-wee's Big Adventure.
All right.
Explorers and The Secret of Nim.
Gosh, 80s movies right there. Okay.
There you go.
See, other old the new titles on Blu-ray, The Disappearance of Eleanor Rigby. No, it's not a Beatles song. This is one with Jessica Chastain and James Gavoy, and they've released three versions of this film. One from his point of view, one from her point of view, and I know there's one called Them, where it's a mixture of their points of view. The horror movie Ouija, which Kobe won't see.
Oh.
The Homesman with Tommy Lee Jones and Hilary Swank. That's also checking out. And on DVD old titles, Diner, which I love, About Schmidt, the last really good Jack Nicholson film, and the psychotic romantic comedy My Best Friend's Wedding. We have time for One Dead Person We Like. Actress Geraldine McEwan, who I first saw her as a sadistic nun in the 2002 drama The Magdalene Sisters. PBS fans know her. She played Miss Marple from 2004 to 2007. She also provided a voice in Wallace and Gromit as Miss Thripp in Curse of the Were-Rabbit. She was also in Vanity Fair, Titus, Love's Labor's Lost. She was Mortiana in Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, Alice in Henry V. But a classic, That Lady. And, of course, she's got a link to PBS. So, Geraldine, thank you so much for your work. Now, ladies and gentlemen, we go with my chat with actor, director, producer. And now he has an Academy Award-nominated film under his belt. He was also one of the Long Riders. And after we talk about Glenn Campbell, I'll Be Me, he indulges my questions about the Long Riders and his brother, Stacy. Here's my chat with James Keach. So, James, why are you in Indianapolis, besides promoting the film?
Indianapolis. We're in Indianapolis promoting the film to meet with Eli Lilly about potential sponsorship for the film in throughout the world.
I'm really glad you made the film. It's really well done. Really enjoyed it, and it gives a warts and all look of what Glenn has had to go through. When did you start filming, and how long did it take?
We started filming in the summer of 2011, thinking it was going to be a 5.5-week tour, and it turned out to be in a 2.5-year shoot, 151 shows. The reason being is when Glenn first came out and said that he had Alzheimer's, and that he was going to go out and tour. He had very few bookings, and I think most people were very fearful that this was going to be a train wreck. And as soon as the audiences saw it, they realized that this was one of the most inspiring things that anybody had ever seen. And the bookings just continued to grow. And so did the reviews. The reviews were very, very positive. And so that's how it ended to be 2.5 years. So I should say that we thought that we would be only doing it for 5.5 weeks, and we're kind of relieved at the thought of doing it, because we couldn't figure out a way to make a show that was going to be uplifting and positive about a guy with Alzheimer's. The producer of his last two albums was a very good friend of mine, and he kept saying, "Come on, James, you've been shooting rock shows for a while. You have all the equipment. Come on, just do it. Just record it for history." Well, we did record it for history, but it also, in doing that, changed our lives, changed my life personally, completely, actually. As a filmmaker and as a guy who was very, very much afraid of what Alzheimer's is and what it might do to somebody, to being an advocate for really wanting to change the conversation about it and to really inform the world as to what we're up against and to let people see what a hero Glenn Campbell is.
Now, you said the producer, record producer, was that how you got involved with the project?
Julian Raymond. Mm-hmm. Julian Raymond who produced Glenn Campbell, I'll Be Me, and Ghost on a Canvas. Was producing my son Johnny, who was 13 at the time, was producing his music and kept coming into the studio and saying, "Come on, man, you got to meet Glenn," because I'd made a movie a few years before called Walk the Line.
Yep.
And produced it, and he said, "You know, we got to do something about Glenn before it's too late." And I didn't know what too late was in the early parts of our conversation. Too late, of course, turned out to be Alzheimer's. And I said to Julian and my partner Trevor Albert, we both said to him, "Look, we made that movie. We did the biopic, and it's not that Glenn's not an incredible story. It's just that you kind of want to try and work on other kinds of pictures, you know." And "You got to meet him. You got to meet him." This went on for 6 months. Finally, he said, he's going to tell the world he's got Alzheimer's. He's going to do a very short tour. Will you meet him, please?" So we said, "Sure, we'll meet him." And Glenn, when he came over, by the way, over the weekend beforehand, we watched everything we could about Alzheimer's. And everything we saw was so, so depressing. It always showed people at the end stages of it, or the scientific version of it. Except The Notebook, which was a beautiful, beautiful film, I thought. Mm-hmm. But it didn't. There weren't documentaries that showed it. And then we met Glenn. Glenn comes into the house, and he's with his beautiful wife Kim, and Johnny's walking across the living room, and has his guitar in his hand, and he goes, "Hey, I play guitar." And Johnny goes, "Yes, sir, I know you play guitar." He says, "You want me to show you something?" And Johnny says, "Sure." And he picks up the guitar and he just shreds it. And he said, "That's what Uncle Boo taught me. You practice that, you'll be good." And then Johnny walked into his bedroom and took his guitar, and Glenn looked at Kim, and he said, "You know what a man findeth a good woman, he findeth a good thing. I found me a good thing. That's my thing." And he's talking to Kim, and she said, and then Kim said to me, "James, you know, Glenn's got Alzheimer's, and we want you to film this." And he says, "What? I got what?" He said, "You got Alzheimer's." He says, "No, I don't. I got part-timers." So you got it right up front. Here was the guy who's in love with his wife, who's an incredible musician, who wasn't afraid to talk about what was going on in his life. Oh, and here comes Johnny walking back across the living room. And Glenn looks over at him and says, "Hey, I play guitar. You want me to show you something?" So we got to see the whole thing right there, like in a period of 5 minutes.
A natural pitch.
And, you know, and it was just like, wow, this guy is so, he's funny, he's self-deprecating, he's engaging, he's and that's what he is in the film. And so just felt that, 5 weeks, the answer Kim says, it's only 5 weeks, you know, it's going to be 5 weeks. you know, okay. And so here we are 4 years later. I'm still talking about it. And the film is just now beginning to begin its journey out into the world. That we were in 80 cities and did probably, I don't know, it's the best reviewed film I've ever made. And if you could imagine the song in the movie called I'm Not Gonna Miss You, and it's the last song, was nominated for an Academy Award. Now, if you can imagine a guy 76 years old with Alzheimer's nominated for an Academy Award and 3 Grammys and the broadcast critics thing, and I mean, it's just like, who would have ever thought? That's not why we got into it. What I'm saying is that when Glenn Campbell said, I ain't done yet, and he was told to hang up his guitar, and here's a guy that, you know, we all, when, you know, given some terrible diagnosis of whatever, Alzheimer's, cancer, heart disease, whatever, a lot of us just go, okay, poor me, and go sit on the pity pot, and that's the end of it. Instead, he said, nope, I'm going to keep playing until I can't play anymore. And in so doing, what he's doing is he's shown the world a way to, the Alzheimer's, he's shown the world a way to live, and his family, the caregiving. It's just, it's a beautiful, beautiful tribute to a family. And for me, as a film, I don't know.
You got it.
Yeah. I got to do it.
Yeah.
You know, which is 1,400 hours of film. I got to do it. Yeah.
So you had not met him before this?
No, I didn't. I had not. They knew of me because of John Cash, and they knew people obviously that knew John Cash, and John Cash was a dear friend of my wife's and mine, and was the godfather of my kids, and he asked me to make that movie. So,
well, I say the amount of footage, and I know you said you shot 1,400, but the amount of footage, warts and all, ups and downs, I wondered if you had known him, because the amount of the access that you were able to get, you know, backstage at home. So the fact that you didn't, I mean, I think that's something to be said about you as a filmmaker, as well as capturing it with the camera.
Well, you know, I think it is something to be said about me as a filmmaker, maybe as a person. I love to talk to people. I like asking questions more than I like talking about, you know, myself. I like sharing stories of people's lives. I'm very interested in where people come from. And Glenn and I and John Cash, we all shared one similar thing. And that is, I didn't have to. All my friends when I was growing up, a little small town in Texas, they picked cotton because that's what they had to do. And I picked cotton because they did, and I wanted to go do it. So I always knew where they came from, these guys, you know, from the cotton fields and struggles with substances there was always an honesty about our conversations. And I think when I said to the family, I said, look, I'm not going to put anything in this film that I wouldn't say about my own dad. And, you know, after a period of time, at first people were reluctant. All the people on the crew, they'd look at you and they'd go, who is this guy? And then, you know, you spend enough time with somebody and you get to know their character. And that's the interesting thing about, for me, going from narrative film to documentary film, is that in narrative film you write the script, and of course the actors, when they're really, the performances are great, they trust you like the families do in the documentaries. They start trusting when you see something nuanced that, you know, you say, you know, that's really good, but maybe let's try it a little different. And they trust that you're not trying to manipulate them into something that you want to see. If you're really good, they're trusting that you want to bring the best out in them, which is a big difference, mm-hmm. You know? And I think the Campbells, they wanted to tell the true story, but they also, dignity was something very important. And I was there to help take care of Glenn. Trevor and I, we became part of the caregiving group. We would take Glenn when you know, he was having a problem or he was lost somewhere, we'd go find him, and you know, we were there all the time. So it became a very different experience, and that's what I mean, because I've become an advocate. I now understand what caregiving is about, mm-hmm. and the role of the caregiver, and how this is just, it's so important that people understand this. And we did a screening in Nashville for 4,000 people at one time, and then we did a concert afterwards. And I was the MC of the show, and the band Perry was playing, and Ashley Campbell and Delta Ray. There was the three bands that were playing after the screening. And I, to cover the time of setting up, I said to the audience, how many people in this audience, I'm just curious, how many people have been touched by Alzheimer's and or caregiving or somebody who knows? And 4,000 people stood up. And I went, and how many of you actually talked to other people about it? And almost all of them sat down. Because there's a whole shame connected with it. There's a whole, you know, embarrassment. There's the, you know, and that's what we, that's what Glenn's doing, right? He's showing us, you don't have to hide. We don't have to, we can understand. We can have compassion for people who have this. And one of the things that was so, so moving and important to me in, as a human being in making the film and really reinforced my faith in humanity was that the audience, when he would play, instead of being judgmental and when he would forget a line or something like that, they cheered him on.
Mm-hmm.
They gave him standing ovation after standing ovation for his courage. And I will say that in between, you know, when he messed something up and then he'd get it back, and when he'd get it back, he'd get it back in spades. He'd just kill it. I mean, he's still a genius musician. But it was still that spirit of and that's why it was, seeing the show was so cool, because it was like an experience. It was you don't know what's going to happen next. It's like a movie where you sit on the edge of your seat and you don't know what's going to happen. Is he going to, is the teleprompter going to break down? Mm-hmm. Or is he going to play in the wrong key, which he did some nights? And the kids had, they learned how to really be good musicians, because he would play, he'd start in the wrong key and he would not come out of it. And so now they had to switch.
They had to adjust.
Exactly. So.
Well, it's funny you mentioned, because you know, Glenn did a show in Carmel, which is just north of here, and I think it was a couple of weeks before it became known, before he went public with Alzheimer's. And of course, the reviews were saying that the performance was erratic, and you know, he'd start, he'd repeat. So, you know, obviously, a couple of weeks later, we finally got the explanation as to why. But yeah, you said watching the show, because I remember this, I think there's a part where his wife says, you know, here's your teleprompter, here's your mark. And as an audience member, when you would see him veer right or veer left, you kind of tense up a little bit and like, oh, I hope he's all right. Hope he makes it. And yeah, and you were able to show sometimes he did and sometimes he didn't.
Right. That makes for good drama, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
That's right. That's one of the things that was so exciting about it. And I was always on stage right. I had his close up camera, so that was the other thing about, you know, going from there. Usually you have Conrad Hall shooting the movie when you're making, you know, something like that. Instead, it's James Keach, and the other guys were all shooting cameras, and it was really exciting, you know. And one night, Glenn at Carnegie Hall, he walked over to me, and he walked right into this giant close-up, and he goes, "Hey, like a rhinestone cowboy," and he puts the mic right in my mouth, and he wants me to sing it with me, and I said, "Stop it, stop that!" You know, and I had to do it. I did it, and the audience cheered. But it was fun.
I was wondering, you mentioned how often did he notice the camera? Whether it was in studio or at home,
he would notice it sometimes. He liked it. You know, he's one of those guys. It's probably like you with that microphone. You like having it in front of you. You feel good because this is your world.
Mm-hmm.
Glenn's world was being on that stage, and he liked, he wanted to make the movie. He wanted us to be around, and he'd forget it. He'd forget that we were there. One of the most moving moments for me filming was at the Mayo Clinic, and they would only allow one camera in, and that was me.
Mm-hmm.
And they're injecting him with dye to do a PET scan of his brain, and he's there, and he wondered where I was right at the beginning, and then he forgot I was even there, because I set up two cameras, and I let one roll for a wide shot over here, and I had a close-up camera straight on him. And there was, and I was pretty far back because I like to use longer lenses. I didn't ever want to get too close to him because I didn't want him to be conscious of me being there. And he just starts singing to Kim, and they go into their own world. And he trusted me as a person, so he always knew that if I was in the room, everything was okay. Somehow that if I was nearby, that he kept him calm. So the camera became a friend to him, his friend. Mm-hmm. I don't think he noticed the camera. He never played to it. He certainly never ever did things for the camera for performance.
And I also wondered if the, you know, depending on what day he had of him wondering, what are these people doing in my house because of the Alzheimer's? That never happened?
Well, a lot of times what we would do with the cameras there is we would set them up and we'd walk away.
Okay.
Yeah, or Kim would set them up and walk away, mm-hmm. you know, and it was just there. And then we would go through the footage.
You mentioned how funny he is, and I think a lot of people forget that. I mean, the guy had a variety show at one time, so we know the musicality. But, yeah, seeing him working with his family, especially with his family on the road, and, yeah, even talking with doctors, he's just a sunlight.
He is. He, you know, he said it in the film, I've laughed and I've cried. It's a hell of a lot better to laugh. And he loved Roger Miller, and he would always tell jokes. He always wanted you to smile. You know,
mm-hmm.
and he still does like people. You go visit with Glenn now, and you don't know what he's laughing about, but he's laughing about something, and he starts laughing so hard that he gets everybody else laughing. You know,
mm-hmm.
he's just an amazing, special, honest guy. That's the other thing that he. He would say things in his Alzheimer's repetitiveness that were very important to him. Like when a man findeth a good woman, talk about Kim. He has very deep belief, very deep faith. And he would also always talk about the importance of telling the truth. You know, and how lying's no good. And then he would talk about drugs. And if there was ever an anti-drug guy, it was him. About how it really messed his life up for a short period of time, but that short period of time, you know, was magnified into a real media thing, and I think the alcohol thing was, I think the alcohol was to self-medicate his the beginnings of his Alzheimer's, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, all this stuff, all the drugs and substance abuse and everything, it's to deal with the pain that comes from so far back in all our lives, you know, and we're trying to self-medicate the pain, I think. That's just my opinion. And when Glenn would talk about his growing up and how tough it was where he came from, and the same thing with John Cash. It was tough, man.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure for many, many people in this country, it's really tough.
Now, not really giving away anything, but we do get to see the final concert, and I know the tour was hit. I mean, they ended the tour on the right note. I guess it was
Napa,
right? And I guess it was best to finish it here, and get out while the getting is good. I guess was that your original intent, or was that their original intent? It was just covering the tour, and then that's it.
The original intent, first of all, the original intent was 5.5 weeks.
Right. Well, yes.
So 2.5 years later, you know, millions of dollars later, oh my gosh, you know, and maybe someday we'll get it back. But that's not the important thing. The important thing is that the world see the film. And I think for your audience that I can promise them that they will be uplifted. And it's funny. There's more big laughs in this movie than there are in major comedies. I mean, it's funny. He is so funny. Your question is, was that the intent to end it here? That was the last book show of that year. And we all felt that Glenn wasn't enjoying it as much. It was agitating him.
Mm.
And yet the night before that show might have been his best show. Which is, that's the thing that's so... so amazing about this thing. And he was still good that night. He's still, you know, Southern Nights, the song he ends with is beautiful. And it's just that, you know, he wasn't enjoying it as much, and it was getting him agitated and stressed out and disoriented. So the whole idea was not to do the show to because we had to do the show because there was a need to make money or anything. It was to prolong Glenn's health. That's ultimately the idea, is to give him the opportunity to do what he loves the most. And it, because we believe, and I think the doctors that have seen the film since subsequently, that this really prolonged his journey as a musician and as a human being. Because soon after we stopped, even though the last song was done several months later, mm-hmm. I filmed that several months later with the Wrecking Crew. He went downhill pretty fast after the tour was over. I mean, we'd go and play little clubs here and there. We'd bring musicians over. One night we went to see Merle Haggard and Toby Keith was there. And we went out into the bus and played, which is really cool. and he could still just kill it, you know. But you know, it's I don't know. Alzheimer's is a tricky thing, man. It breaks your heart. It breaks your heart when you. It breaks the hearts of the people that are around the people more than it breaks the hearts of the people that are suffering from it, at least in the end stages. Mm-hmm. In the beginning stages, when you know you have it and you're facing it, you know, it's not easy.
Well, and shifting gears a little bit, congratulations on the film getting a nomination for the song. I know it's – will you be at the Oscars?
I hope so. Yeah, I will. I will. I'm a member of the Academy, so I'll be there. But it got nominated for 3 Grammys too.
Yes. Congrats on that as well.
Which I just think is, you know, it got nominated for Best Video for the Country Music Association. So, you know, I am not a spring chicken, so – and this is my first music video. So it's never too late. It's never too late. You can go out there and make your music video. I tell you that now.
Well, I'm not going to ask your age, but I do love directors with a 6, a 7, and an 8 in their age still making work. Still, I mean, I play jazz and blues musicians that are in their 90s still putting out product, still putting out work.
That's good, man.
Absolutely.
Hey, man. You know, I mean, listen, look at Clint. I did a movie with Clint with Robert Duvall a few years ago.
Stars Fall on Henrietta.
Yeah, right. And I'll never forget Clint. I said, "Do you have one note for me, Clint?" He said, "Yeah. If you got the shot, move the camera." Meaning, don't do the same take twice, which is really interesting because he's so sparse, you know, in what he does. And here's the absurdity of the Academy. Here's a guy. This is maybe his best film in many, many, many years, and he's not nominated. You know, I mean, come on, guys. I mean, you know, it's like, you know, it's there's such politics in all these organizations. You know, if you're not a member of the doc branch, you're not a member of the little club. You know, you're a member of the narrative branch. You know, it's if you're not a member of the narrative branch, you know, and you're a member of the doc branch, it's just, you know, it's human nature. You know, we're all in our little cliques, and mm-hmm. you know, but Clint's work is remarkable.
Two films in 1 year.
Yeah. And one of which I did not care for at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I wondered, what the heck did you do that for? You know, and although there was some good stuff in it, but I guess he did it because he wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
And that he loved that period of music because he loves music.
Yep.
You know, and it wasn't a bad film. I mean, well, I like the play better. How's that?
Sure. That's all right.
I enjoyed the play more. But... you know, for those people who never knew who those guys were, the Jersey Boys, and the kids that are growing up, your kids, my kids.
It's a good 101.
Yeah, it is. It's a good thing for them to see, and it'll live, and it'll be fine. So, but that compared to American Sniper, my God.
Mm-hmm. And I think he's been able to, I mean, you know, he retired the tough guy. He retired his Western persona with Unforgiven. He retired his tough guy persona with Gran Torino. And he's been able to direct anything he wants, whether it's Jersey Boys or American Sniper or Bridges in Madison County or Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil. You know, to be able to direct what you want and have a studio backing you on that, that's rare.
Yeah, yeah. You got to be named Glenn Eastwood.
Now, you said you'd filmed concert footage before. Who else have you shot?
I went out with Cheap Trick.
Yeah?
Yeah, Johnny, the kid opened for Cheap Trick for 2 years. So that's what we were doing. Cool. It was fun.
Between your film and Still Alice, there is a lot, you know, people are talking more about Alzheimer's. I've even been approached by a lot of people, whether it's on the street or at festivals. You know, you mentioned the Nashville event. Has that become almost a daily occurrence now?
We have requests for around 300 screenings, and it's just going to grow exponentially, I think. And, you know, we were reading yesterday in China, the number is staggering, how many people have it. So I think the long tail of this movie is going to be great. And I think, too, that the thing that's exceptional about it is that there's music in it. It makes it so palpable because, you know, you get to see a guy play his music, and it's good music. And the Still Alice movie and Julianne Moore's performance is really good. There's no question about it. There's not a lot of laughs, and it's a narrative linear progression from you got it to you're out of it, and Glenn is the difference. Of course, is one is real and one is imagined, mm-hmm. and I think we screened it here actually at Lilly a few weeks ago, and the head of their Japanese global marketing division saw it, and she wants to take it to Japan, and so take it to Australia, and it's a huge problem in China. And the thing that's cool about it is that it's a very entertaining film. So if you can entertain people, inform them, empower them, inspire them, get them to want to make a change, we got a shot at slowing this sucker down, because we need everybody to. We need financial support to do it, you know. And I think that most people have perceived this as being an old person's thing, and it's not. The people that are going to suffer the most from it are the young people, because they're going to have to take care of the old people. It's going to break the economy, which is a frightening thing, mm-hmm. you know. I mean, just to talk realistically, 2050 it'll exceed the national. 2025 it'll exceed the national defense budget. 2050 you'll start breaking the economy.
You said it took 2.5 years. What did you do in between? I mean, did you have pockets of time where you were able to work on other projects, or were
not
you just
really.
Kind of on standby?
No, not really. This has been my life for a while.
Well, it's not just Steve James who has the multi-year commitments when it comes to making documentaries. You are now a part of that club. So
yeah.
Congratulations.
Thanks.
If I may, I wanted to shift gears a little bit. I wanted to personally thank you for creating The Long Riders.
Ah, good.
I got to see that with my dad when it came out. Where did that start? Where did telling the story of the James family come about for you?
My brother and I did a movie called Orville and Wilbur.
Yep.
We played the Wright brothers. And so we thought, let's play the Wrong brothers. So Stacy and I, you know, he at the time, he's 7 years older, and at the time he was just starting to really ascend as a movie star. And I went off and I was into music, and I said, we'll try and write it as a country western musical. We did it as the Bandit Kings, and so we made a musical about the James Gang. I just thought it would be cool because it was the time Keith was doing Hair and Keith Carradine, and, mm-hmm. and you know, there was a lot of musicals being done, and Godspell, and it was a cool time in the theater in New York, and so we started to do that, and then
But when he says the James Gang, he doesn't mean the group with Joe Walsh. That's another group.
Yeah, this is the Jesse James
the actual
gang.
Jesse James gang.
Jesse James, Cole Younger, you know, the Miller Brothers, yeah. So we did it for a while, and we played it at the Bowery Lane Theater, and it was fun. And then we said, let's try and develop it into a movie. So we took the script and wrote the script, and then I was doing a film in Bora Bora with Tim Zinnemann. And Tim Zinnemann had done a movie with Walter Hill, and he said, what are you working on all the time? And I said, I'm working on this. And he said, let me read it. And he said, you know who'd like this is Walter Hill. And so he said, can you get all those guys? And I said, I don't know. Yeah, I think we can. So Keith was doing an album, and so we went to the record plant. It's burned down now, the record plant. In Hollywood, and we got the Bridges brothers, the Carradine brothers, the Keats brothers, and we all went out into the alley. It was like 2 a.m, and we took a picture of all of us together, and we sent it to them, and that began the journey. The Bridges brothers eventually weren't able to do it, and it became the Guest brothers, Chris and Nick Guest, and the Quaids were in the picture too, Randy and Dennis Quaid. So. Yeah, so that original script, we wrote the original script, and Walter came in and did a rewrite on the script. We did a rewrite on that script, and then we went and we made it, and it was awesome.
Where'd you shoot it?
We shot it in Clayton, Georgia, Albany, Georgia, Texas, and Sonora, California, where they had the trains, where they had the single gauge trains.
Besides the brothers casting, which I think is a great marketing tool, not a gimmick, but I also read that Walter Hill and wanted to have a family feel on the film, and obviously that paid off not only with your brothers, but the film also humanizes these characters that we kind of grew up knowing as being notorious bad guys, and then seeing them at home chopping wood, dealing with the women in their lives. You know, that seemed more interesting than just black hats versus white hats.
Well, that's what it was, you know. It was like, you know, when Jesse's mother was and his brother was tortured, and they were, you know, you understood why they did what they did, you know, why they were so upset about everything, and why, you know, they went after the Pinkertons. One of the things about wars that we don't understand is we see all the people running down the streets, you know, the Iranians, the Iraqis. We don't have compassion for the fact that they, you know, those kids are born and they're nurtured and they're loved and they're, you know, we dehumanize them in some way, and which is sad. And in this case, the James gang, this was a family, and they were wronged. In my opinion, they were wronged by the North. They were, you know, and they took it upon themselves, rightly or wrongly, to seek revenge for it, you know.
Now, how was it working with Walter Hill as a director, and did he later influence you as a director?
I love Walter. Walter, here's Walter. I love telling this story. I can tell it now, years later. So we're out in front of a Corkindale barn, and there's a big shootout. And on the, you know, in those days, they probably still do. The barn, they would squib the barn. They put squibs. They put M13s or whatever things in the barn. And they would blow holes in it to appear as if bullet holes were coming through. So that you get, and then they'd backlight it so that the light would come flashing through, and you'd see all these holes in the barn. So I'm out there with a rifle, and I'm shooting in front of the barn, and there's this whole thing going on, you know, big raid, and about three of these M13s blow up, and they hit me in the back, and it blows holes literally in my back, you know, and blood and my knees buckle, because I'm just
right,
not like I can't hold myself up. I've been hit, and I'm going down on the ground, and I'm shooting. It's in slow motion, and it's cool, and I hear Walter go, God, Keith, damn it, if you ever do that again, I'll bullwhip you. What are you talking about? They're carrying me off to the hospital. He said, you can't fall down like that. You're Jesse James. Walter, you know, I had stitches in my back and everything. He was funny. He always appeared to be a tough guy. He was John Ford's second assistant director. So, you know, and
he survived Peckinpah as well.
Right, he survived Peckinpah, and he liked to wear the eye patch and all that stuff, you know. And but he's a terrific filmmaker and a good guy, and you know, he liked making those tough guy movies. He was good at it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It also makes me want to have Ry Cooter provide the soundtrack of my life.
Ry Cooter's pretty darn good.
Pretty good.
Pretty darn
not
good.
Not bad at all.
Not bad at all.
So, as you said, you're 7 years younger than Stacey. What's it like to direct your brother?
Well, now he asks me to direct him in lots of movies. For many years, he was like, hey, kid, you know. So now I think he figures I've proved myself as a filmmaker. But it's actually his... He was directing. The reason I wanted to become a director was because of him. He was doing a movie, down in Alabama, about an Alabama prison, and he was doing a little documentary. And I came into the editing room and I would watch him cut it, and it was just so fascinating to me how films were put together. I loved it, so I really fell in love with the whole idea of it. And I still am in love with it. It's still magic to me.
Mm-hmm.
Still 90 minutes in the dark is magic. Going to the movies and making movies is it's the coolest thing you can do.
What are you working on next?
You know, it's interesting. We've developed a lot of narrative scripts, but I am leaning towards making documentaries. During the period of this film, because of the caregiver and all the stuff that caregivers go through, we started talking to people who've been connected with the military with post-traumatic stress syndrome. And it's fascinating to talk to them about the moral injury that takes place when you have to do things like in war that you shouldn't do, that it goes against your conscience. And caregiving, and when you're dealing with people with health, the problems that you have. So there's something very interesting to me about that moral injury thing that takes place in all of us that causes addiction, that causes pain, that causes. So I'm kind of intrigued to look at that area and to try and find to make a movie kind of like Glenn's movie that's inspirational, but that will allow people to see and to have empathy for people who have to, like soldiers who do things like this and what they go through and how we can help them, and people who are caregivers, how we can help them and how we can help ourselves, heal ourselves. So I suppose that's something that's an area that I'm interested in. And I don't know, I think there's a lot to be said about it, and I think there's not a lot said about it.
And now that you have a title of director of an Academy Award-nominated documentary, that will hopefully get a little more incentive.
I don't know. I hope so.
Fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed.
Silent Breed is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
Big thanks to James Keach. Go look for Glenn Campbell, I'll Be Me. Still Alice is out there. And look up more about Alzheimer's if you haven't already. Go see a good movie. You deserve it. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD to the Point and WFYI.org.
We gone.
Good night, Michigan.
Good night, Fort Myers. Good night, California.
I got that in.